You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime, Three Men and a Mystery,
All Things Crime,
and Zodiac Speaking. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Episode 14, Gwen Miller. It was 1968. I wasn't born yet, and I'm sure that many of you weren't either. But 60-year-old Gwen Miller was living and working in Rapid City, South Dakota. She was a professional woman who lived on her own at 3901 Hall Street in a modest home she had designed and had built for herself. On Thursday, February 29th, in the 1968 leap year, Gwen didn't show up for work at her usual time. Known for her dedication to her job and punctual nature, Gwen's absence was cause for alarm. Several of Gwen's co-workers knew of her health struggles and that, over the years, she had been in and out of the hospital numerous times, suffering from diabetic comas. So, when she failed to come into work and they could not reach her on her home phone, Nurse Gail Luce and another nursing colleague decided to head over to Gwen's house on Hall Street. One of the nurses found that the front door was locked and there was no sign of Gwen. She knocked on the door of a next-door neighbor, named in contemporary articles as Mrs. Dave Strain. By the way, it's crazy that in 1968, women were still referred to only in the context of their husbands' names. Anyway, Mrs. Strain said she had a key to Gwen's house, which Gwen had given her in case of emergency. But then, before she could look for it, one of the nurses went around the back of the home and saw that a pane of glass on the back door had been broken, and the door was unlocked. It was the only sign that anything was amiss. The women entered the back door, carefully stepping over the glass shards that lay on the floor. The small house was neat as a pin. And in the bedroom, Gwen was lying peacefully in her bed, on her back. She looked like she was asleep, with her hair neatly arranged on the pillow. The nurses must have felt somewhat awkward approaching the prone woman whose bed covers were neatly pulled up nearly to her chin, giving them just a glimpse of her nightgown. But when they tried to rouse her, they suffered a shock, because it was clear that Gwen was dead. 911 was not yet a thing in 1968, so instead, the distraught women used Gwen's home phone to call the Pennington County Sheriff's Office for help. Let's pause the story here to take a look at who Gwen was. Gwen Vivian Miller was born in Crespard, South Dakota on November 4th, 1907, the most senior of the victims I've covered, as she was born more than a century ago. Gwen grew up on a farm in Crespard with her father John Lambert Miller, mother Belle Shaw Miller, brother Wendell Miller, and sister Inez Miller Harris. Gwen graduated from Crespard Consolidated High School and went on to college. Gwen worked all her adult life as a pharmacist, receiving her certification in 1930 after completing a three-year pharmaceutical chemistry course of study at South Dakota State College. She received her Bachelor of Science in Pharmacy with advanced work in microbiology in 1937. We don't need to look at every detail of Gwen's professional life, but throughout her career as a pharmacist, she lived and worked in South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. She also worked for Abbott Labs in Illinois. Her jobs included positions at Sioux Valley Hospital Pharmacy, Huron Clinic Pharmacy, Woodward's Pharmacy in Aberdeen, and Mills Drug in Rapid City. She also taught student nurses in chemistry, medical material, and microbiology, and was the buyer and custodian of general hospital supplies at Sioux Valley Hospital in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. In 1945, she moved to Rapid City to work for Mills Drugs, and she would remain in that city for the rest of her life. In early 1968, she became the chief pharmacist at Bennett Clarkson Memorial Hospital, which is now Rapid City Regional. That is the job she held at the time of her death, although she was planning to retire before too long. As I indicated earlier, Gwen consistently faced health challenges that could have slowed her down. She suffered from diabetes and had been hospitalized on many occasions in the past. Descriptions of her physique use words like pale, slight, and sickly. Nevertheless, Gwen seemed to enjoy her life and make the most of it. After residing in Rapid City for 7 years, in 1952, Gwen purchased a lot on Hall Street on the west side of town. This was a nice, family-oriented neighborhood. Gwen had a modest one-level ranch-style home built to her specifications, and she moved into that house, number 3901 Hall Street, in 1953. Gwen took care of her small home, keeping it neat and clean, and tending to her rose garden in the backyard. Although she was not gregarious, everyone in the neighborhood knew her as a kindly, quiet person whom the neighborhood kids loved to stop and chat with. They all knew that if she ever started acting strange, they needed to give her a piece of candy. Gwen's disease wasn't totally debilitating, but it definitely impacted her on a daily basis and dictated her lifestyle to a certain degree. Gwen never married and didn't have any children of her own. This seems to be at least partially because she didn't want to burden anyone with her health struggles. Gwen had colleagues at work whom she was friendly with, but after her death, they realized that she had not shared many personal matters with them, and she did not have any really close friends. But she was very close to her large extended family. She loved to travel to visit her nieces and nephews. One story about her was that one Christmas she babysat for her niece Dolores Lindgren's new baby daughter, while Dolores and her husband Jim went holiday shopping. When they got home, they lamented that they couldn't afford baby's red velvet dress that they had seen in one of the stores. A few days later, a package showed up with the dress for the baby, purchased and sent by Gwen. Gwen had saved up and bought herself a 1966 gold Chevy Supersport. But her family said that despite being proud of her new car, she didn't drive it all that much. Instead, she took taxis to and from work every day. Again, this might have been because she was concerned about having a diabetic episode while she was driving. In 1957, at age 50, Gwen had been in a head-on collision with a truck, an accident that caused hundreds of dollars worth of damage to the vehicles. It's not known what the cause of this accident was. But in any event, Gwen took pride in her car, her home, and her job. Gwen's independence, self-sufficiency, and lifelong dedication to her career are remarkable considering she was born well before women in the United States could even vote. She was actually quite progressive for her time. One fact that investigators would uncover about Gwen's habits, for she was someone who thrived on routine, involved her next-door neighbors from the years 1962 to 1967. This was a young couple, and the wife was a beautician. Every Saturday, Gwen would go to this house and sit and have her hair done by the young woman. Gwen spoke highly of the woman to others, but she did not approve of the woman's husband, who was apparently abusive, and she let the woman know her feelings on the matter. The husband was eventually ruled out as a suspect in Gwen's death, but Gwen's regular visits to this home and the people she encountered there would turn out to be significant much, much later. As I mentioned, Gwen loved to travel and was always taking trips to visit people and places. She was the women's volunteer chaperone for the nearby School of Mines and would accompany the young female students on geological excursions and trips. In February 1968, just days before her death, she had one of these trips to an overseas location planned and booked, but President Johnson put a hold on all U.S. citizens' international travel. The trip was canceled. Gwen called her niece Dolores in Washington State, told her about her disappointment, and made a plan to go visit Dolores and her family instead. Gwen would never take that trip. She was killed before it could happen. And Dolores' telephone conversation with her aunt was the last time anyone in the Miller family spoke with Gwen. Okay, back to February 1968. Gwen's body was submitted for an autopsy. Remember, reportedly she had few to no visible injuries to her person and looked undisturbed to the point that at first, investigators assumed she had died in her sleep. But they requested an autopsy because the broken window in her otherwise orderly home raised some red flags. And sure enough, upon closer examination, the Pennington County Coroner George Behrens determined that Gwen had been manually strangled. Thumbprints were detected on either side of her throat. She had a fractured hyoid bone and broken cartilage in her neck, and she had petechial hemorrhage in her eyes, a sure sign of strangulation. Her death had actually been quite violent. Several broken ribs led to the conclusion that her killer had been kneeling on her chest as she was assaulted, and she had been raped. Whether this took place before death or after was unknown. Although the time of death could not be established, it was clear that Gwen had been killed sometime during the night of February 28th to 29th. Pennington County Sheriff's Office crime scene technicians, who were, of course, working according to 1968 protocols, did a thorough job. The glass on the back door that was shattered had sent shards into the house where they lay on the floor. This told investigators that the glass had been broken from the outside, likely by an intruder. A half of a brick, likely the implement used to shatter the glass, lay on the ground nearby. The other half brick was never found, and investigators could never be sure if the brick was broken and half of it removed by the intruder, or it had always been broken and he just used the half to smash the pane. As suspected, the means of ingress was determined to be the back door, which the killer had reached in and unlocked through the broken pane. Gwen's family said that she was cautious about locking her doors, and so it made sense to investigators that the killer had been forced to risk raising the alarm by breaking the glass to get to the door lock. No one knows why the sound of breaking glass didn't rouse Gwen, or perhaps it did, but she was overcome before she could react. Neighbors did not report hearing screams or anything else, although the daughter of one neighbor did vaguely remember hearing glass breaking from somewhere outside that night and not thinking much about it. As for the scene in the bedroom, investigators observed that there was no blood on the bed or anywhere else. There were no signs of a struggle, and Gwen had not been bound or restrained. In fact, what's bizarre is that it appeared to investigators that the killer, whoever he was, seemed to have tidied up before he left. He placed the covers neatly over Gwen's body, replaced anything that had become disarrayed in her room, and smoothed her hair so it looked as though she was simply sleeping. There was no upended furniture, nothing noticeably out of place, and no weapons of any sort lying around. The room appeared in pristine condition, with even the bed covers smoothed over Gwen's prone body. The only thing found were some body hairs collected from Gwen's bedding. Since she was not known to have a boyfriend, it was thought they could have come from the killer, but they turned out to be her own. Investigators collected the bedding, Gwen's clothing, the hairs, the brick, the glass, and several other items and put them into evidence. They could never have foreseen the value that some of these items would prove one day to have. Crime scene techs also dusted the house for prints and lifted quite a few of them, including some fresh ones on the headboard of Gwen's bed. All the prints that were not immediately connected to someone were submitted to the FBI crime lab in Washington within 4 days of the murder, but they did not match any of the thousands of fingerprints that the FBI had on file. And eventually, all but one of the prints were matched up to people who had been in Gwen's house, the nurses who found her, the paramedics, sheriff deputies, and so on. One print remained that was not matched to anyone. It was a partial, found on a windowsill, but was described to me as having unique aspects, so that it could effectively be used in comparison to other prints. It was not clear whether the killer had worn gloves. There were no smudged finger impressions visible when fingerprint dust was applied, the way there usually is when gloved fingers come in contact with surfaces. But then why would the killer not have left more prints behind? Perhaps he was careful not to touch anything and to wipe things down before he left, as we know he tidied up the bedroom. A careful inventory of the home indicated that Gwen's billfold and checkbook had been taken. Investigators considered whether the case could have been a robbery gone wrong, but then decided the theft was an afterthought because other valuables remained in plain sight. Gwen herself seems to have been the object of the killer's attentions. Whether she was targeted for personal reasons or was the victim of a random attack was unknown and unsettling to the residents of Rapid City. The local press had a bit of a field day with this case. Violent murders were rare in Rapid City, especially in 1968. And since there were no known suspects, a theory sprang up in the mainstream media that Gwen had been killed by a, quote, sexual pervert, who had spied on her from the bushes as she bathed and put on her nightclothes. Cold case investigator Wayne Keefe, who brought this case to a resolution in 2019, informed me that these stories had no basis in truth. There were no mysterious footprints outside Gwen's windows or peeping Toms reported by anyone. There was the one partial print from a windowsill in the bedroom, but that was the only evidence that anyone was watching Gwen at all. But one neighbor did see something outside Gwen's house. She reported to investigators that she had seen a taxi dropping a person off at Gwen's home earlier on the night of February 28th, around 10:30 p.m. She recalled the time because it was just as the evening news was concluding. She could not make out the name of the taxi company or even the sex or race of the person who got out of the cab, which drove away after dropping its fare. This was a significant lead. There was only one taxi service in Rapid City at the time, and taxi companies keep records. Police spent hundreds of man hours looking at these records and interviewing taxi drivers. They even had some of these men submit to polygraph examinations, which was no small task, since at the time, the state's only polygrapher was located in Sioux Falls. They were never able to locate any taxi that had dropped anyone off at Gwen's home that night. It is not known to this day what the deal was with this taxi sighting or whether the neighbor could have been mistaken. But the taxi story took on major significance in the media, with reports that a taxi had been found containing prints that matched those found in Gwen's house, which was not true. And the taxi story played a big role in the public's mind, as it seemed to point to a suspect, as we will see in a minute. Detective Keefe, the cold case investigator who closed this case, believes that there was a taxi there that night, and for whatever reason, they just failed to find it. Revisiting the case over the past few years, he expended countless hours trying to track down the woman who had reported the taxi, and was only ever able to speak to her husband, who did not recall the incident. Keefe spoke with the four original investigators on the case, who recalled that the woman who had reported the taxi had lived catty corner across the street from Gwen. Keefe even pulled all the taxi company records out and perused them himself, to no avail. If the taxi story was true, it could mean that a man had been dropped at Gwen's home late in the evening. Not exactly a crime. Perhaps she did, after all, have a paramour. But it also could have been Gwen herself emerging from the cab that night. Remember, she usually took taxis to and from work. Or there could have been no taxi at all. Investigators started working to investigate the men in Gwen's life. She was not known to date and had no exes to speak of, though, so they were relegated to looking at acquaintances and co-workers. Investigators canvassed Gwen's neighborhood and questioned hundreds of neighbors, acquaintances, colleagues, associates, and friends of hers. Some agreed to submit to lie detector tests and were ruled out. Police also put together a chain gang of sorts, six prisoners from the city jail who were tasked with conducting an inch-by-inch grid search of the field behind Gwen's home. Nothing was found. And missives were sent to other law enforcement agencies all over the country seeking information on any similar crimes. Shortly after Gwen's murder, according to the Rapid City Journal, Rapid City police learned of the arrest of a man in eastern South Dakota that might have had a connection to Gwen. There were some whisperings about a former pharmacist from Nebraska who knew Gwen and who was a drug addict. This went nowhere, and Detective Keefe believes that the media got some of these facts wrong. In another false lead, a watch turned up with G. Miller engraved on it. Someone bought the watch from someone else and noted the inscription, but this too turned out to be a red herring. Very quickly, though, police believed that they were closing in on a prime suspect. One man would become the focus of the Gwen Miller investigation for decades and remain so even after his death. Investigators were convinced for various reasons that he was Gwen's killer. This was a Rapid City man named Michael Beckers. Like Gwen, Beckers was born in 1907 to German parents Catherine and Wynand Bechin. It seems that at some point, the family of 12, yes, 10 kids, Americanized their surname and it became Beckers. Although Michael was born in Nebraska, he grew up in South Dakota, went to high school in Gregory, and graduated from the University of Omaha with a degree in pharmacy. He moved to Rapid City in 1934, where he started out working for Doherty Drugstore, but went on to open his own successful pharmacy, Becker's Drug, on Main Street in downtown Rapid City. He was also active in the community, serving on the South Dakota Pharmaceutical Board and the Board of Directors of the Rapid City Chamber of Commerce, as well as being a member of the Elks Club. He married Florence Mohn in 1939, but their only child died. So why was Michael Beckers so intriguing to investigators? There were several reasons. One, Gwen had worked for him for several years as a part-time pharmacist, supplementing her hospital job. And two, not only were Beckers and Gwen work colleagues, but investigators learned that Beckers had taken a liking to the female pharmacist. It's not at all clear what exactly happened between the two of them, but Gwen mentioned to some co-workers that Beckers had repeatedly propositioned her and she rejected his advances and quit his employ. Something he did, or the person he was, clearly rubbed Gwen the wrong way. Another intriguing fact about Beckers, he was an alcoholic and was known to prefer to take taxis rather than drive himself. And on several occasions, he had shown up at Gwen's door. On one of these occasions, police had to intervene to remove him, as he was pounding on Gwen's door, causing a disturbance, and would not leave. Neighbors called the police, and they arrived and escorted Beckers from the premises. He wasn't arrested, probably because his behavior was chalked up to him being a drunk. But this incident occurred just 1 year before Gwen was killed. The convergence of all these suspicious factors in one person. He liked to take taxis, he had a fixation on Gwen that had turned obsessive, he knew where she lived, he had a history of erratic, possibly violent behavior, resulted in Beckers becoming prime suspect number one, not only for investigators, but for the public. In the court of public opinion, Beckers was the murderer of Gwen Miller. Rumors about his guilt became so prevalent, officials felt the need to address it. An April 1968 article in the Rapid City Journal quotes Pennington County State's Attorney R. James Brennan saying, quote, "Police and the Sheriff's Office are continuing their investigation and exploring every avenue possible. A substantial number of persons have been contacted by law enforcement officers who are seeking information on Ms. Miller's known acquaintances or other information which might prove pertinent. At present, there is an unfounded rumor existing in the community that an individual has been arrested. Until there is an official statement from the state's attorney or the sheriff, these rumors can only jeopardize the continued investigation of this crime. These baseless rumors can do irreparable damage to an individual and can also cause other persons who have fragmentary information from stating anything for fear they themselves may become targets of the gossip." I'm stretching here a little bit, but I imagine it's a similar situation to what we've witnessed in some modern crimes such as the Delphi murders, in which members of the public focus on specific individuals they believe are likely suspects and drag their names through the mud. There was never enough evidence of Becker's involvement to charge him in Gwen's death, but it's safe to say that he lived out the remainder of his life under a shadow of suspicion. Beckers died in April 1973. 11 months after Gwen's murder, her case was already being referred to in the papers as taking longer to solve than other local murders in the past. Rapid City, which had a population of about 45,000 in 1970, had a very low violent crime rate. There were very few unsolved murders, and Gwen's was one of the few. But investigators were baffled. On the second anniversary of her death, Detective Sergeant Carol Bowes of the Rapid City Police Department told the Journal, quote, "The investigation is far from over. It bothers me that we still have an unsolved murder in Rapid." Sheriff Glenn Best also commented that there was no one prime suspect, rather several persons of interest. But when the case was reopened decades later, the cold case detective, Wayne Keefe, approached the case with the belief that Michael Beckers was the likely killer. He would prove to be wrong. The killer was someone else entirely. In both 2005 and 2010, agents from the South Dakota Division of Criminal Investigation did some work on this case. Somewhat miraculously, all the samples from Gwen's autopsy and her nightgown stained with seminal fluid were still in evidence, carefully preserved by the detectives in 1968. Using these materials, the DCI was able to obtain a DNA profile of a male suspect. They ran it through CODIS regularly, but there was never a match. In 2014, the Rapid City Police Department hired its first cold case investigator in an attempt to clear the few unsolved cases that continued to plague the agency. they appointed retired Rapid City Detective Wayne Keefe to the job. And his first order of business was to solve the case of Gwen Miller's murder, which had happened when he was just 2 years old. In light of modern technology, Gwen's case was believed to be solvable because there was still viable DNA in evidence. This was somewhat ironic because the case was so old that some of the original reports were scrawled in pen on onion skin paper. And it was a miracle that there was any evidence remaining at all. A massive flood in June 1972 killed 238 people in Rapid City and destroyed the police department's records section, located in the basement of a building on Main Street. The entire basement was filled with silt after the floodwaters receded. Only two pages of the original police reports on the case were preserved. Fortunately, the sheriff's office had all of its original reports still intact, and they had investigated the case alongside the RCPD. And as I mentioned, the clothing Gwen was wearing, the half brick, and the partial fingerprint were all still intact in evidence at the Pennington County Evidence Facility, and a male DNA profile had been isolated from the physical evidence. After familiarizing himself with the files and evidence, Keefe, like many before him, reached the conclusion that Michael Beckers was indeed the most likely suspect in the murder of Gwen Miller. At this point, knowing that Beckers was long dead, Keefe thought that his job might entail simply confirming the long-held suspicions regarding Beckers' guilt. Keefe reached out to Beckers' relatives and interviewed them. The ones he contacted had no idea that Michael was ever a murder suspect. Several of them agreed to give a DNA sample for comparison to the profile developed in Gwen's case. The samples were sent to the state lab in Pierre, and Keefe waited for the results. When Detective Keefe got the DNA test results back and there was no match between the DNA of Michael Becker's relatives and the killer of Gwen Miller, he was floored. He told me that he sat down with the original investigators on the case and told them that their suspect, Michael Beckers, was cleared by DNA technology. These old-timers were so convinced that Beckers did it, Keefe told me, that they said the DNA must be wrong. But, of course, it wasn't. Someone else, not Michael Beckers, had killed Gwen. Now, with Beckers ruled out, Keefe was starting work on a more than 40-year-old case with an incomplete case file from scratch. It was an almost impossible task. After reviewing all the case files and evidence he had, Keefe was convinced that whoever killed Gwen had been known to her. He told KOTA-TV that, quote, all the information on the case leads investigators to believe that whoever did this knew her. Keefe set about interviewing over 100 people and clearing 25 possible suspects, men who were named in the original file and neighbors and co-workers of Gwen's, using DNA and/or the partial fingerprint that had unique aspects. In 2018, Keefe heard for the first time about the leads being generated in cold cases by forensic genealogy. He reached out to Identifinders International LLC, the company founded by the pioneer of forensic genealogy, Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick. Dr. Fitzpatrick agreed to work with the Rapid City Police Department, and so Keefe submitted to her the DNA profile that had been developed. Dr. Fitzpatrick specializes in tracing Y DNA, which follows the male lineage. Using specialized software, public DNA databases, and her own research techniques, Dr. Fitzpatrick was able to pinpoint 6 or 7 near matches who shared the same Y DNA component. These were distant relatives of the suspect along a paternal line which shared the family name of Field or Fields. The suspect was Caucasian, of Northern European descent, with influences from Scandinavia and the British Isles. Now Detective Keefe had somewhere to start, but it wasn't much of a lead. The name Field was not in the case file anywhere. No one by that name had been interviewed or even mentioned, as far as Keefe could detect from the remaining records. Using a series of bound Rapid City Polk directories at the public library, which cross-referenced local residents by name, occupation, marriage, residential addresses over the years, and so on, Keefe was able to create a spreadsheet of all Fields or variation on Fields who were in the area from 1949 to 1975. There were 49 of them, and the work was painstaking. But he got lucky. There were only 2 subjects who lived in the immediate Rapid City area in 1968 and were the right age to have killed Gwen. Their last name was Field, and one of them, Eugene Carroll Field, had lived less than 3/4 of a mile from Gwen's house around the time of the murder. Eugene Field's name was nowhere in the Gwen Miller case file, and the original investigators did not recall hearing the name, and he was dead. Detective Keefe had his work cut out for him. Let's talk about our suspect. Eugene Carroll Field was born on February 18, 1943, to mother Laureen Evans and father Vern Field. Although he was born elsewhere, the Fields moved to Rapid City when Eugene was young, and he graduated from Rapid City High School. After high school, Field became an airplane mechanic. He served in the South Dakota National Guard and spent time in Texas on a training mission in 1962. Unfortunately, at the time, fingerprinting was not conducted for National Guard members. If it had been, it's likely Field would have been caught almost immediately after the murder. In 1963, at age 20, Field married Judith Lauer. They divorced, and in 1970, he got married again, at age 27, to Carmen Zylstra. He was 25 years old and between marriages when he murdered Gwen Miller in 1968. Detective Keefe set to work to determine how and when Eugene Field and Gwen Miller's paths had crossed, and he found out some interesting things. We already know that Field lived near Gwen's home on the west side of Rapid City. He worked his way up at Western Airlines, eventually becoming a ticket agent at Rapid City Regional Airport. In those days, in the late 60s, ticket agents had a lot more interaction with the passengers than they do today. Airline tickets had to be purchased in person. There was no internet. Remember that Gwen traveled quite a bit and was in and out of the small Rapid City Airport all the time. It seems likely that Field could have been her ticket agent at the airline window on numerous occasions. Western was one of the few airlines that flew in and out of that airport. Further, Detective Keefe speculates that it's very possible that Gwen and this guy Field had some personal interaction 2 or 3 days before she was killed. If you recall, her overseas trip was canceled last minute, and Gwen changed plans and decided to travel to visit her relative Dolores. Well, Gwen would have had to go to the airport to change her ticket, almost certainly on Western Airlines, which would have provided regional service to a larger airport where Gwen could change planes to get to her foreign destination. So we have a possible connection between Gwen and Field here, but there was more. The two had a history of sorts. Remember the beautician, the next-door neighbor of Gwen's who did her hair for several years in the mid-1960s? Well, Detective Keefe tracked her down after he learned the name of his suspect. Now that he had an ID for the killer, he wanted to revisit all the original interviewees to see if the name Eugene Field triggered any memories. And it did. This woman, the beautician and friend of Gwen's, told Detective Keefe that she and her husband had rented out a basement room in their house to a tenant for several months in 1963. The tenant's name was Eugene Field. He was a school buddy and friend of her husband's. And this man was in the house more than once when Gwen Miller came over on Saturdays to have her hair done. Field encountered Gwen on several occasions. He would have known that Gwen lived next door alone. There was additional evidence that Field's one daughter from his first marriage went to a babysitter who lived a few doors down from Gwen. Field was estranged from his first wife and child, but clearly he had firsthand knowledge of Hall Street in the 1960s. The beautician did not recall reporting back in 1968 when Gwen was killed that in 1963 she had had a male tenant in her home who had met Gwen. After all, it was 5 years earlier. Likely she'd forgotten all about it or assumed it was not relevant. This is why Field's name was not in the case file and he was never looked at or talked to by the original investigators. The fact that Field and the beautician's abusive husband were friends is an interesting detail, because the two men were like-minded in their approach to the women in their lives. Detective Keefe interviewed both of Field's ex-wives, and they both said that Field subjected them to emotional and physical abuse and beat them in fits of rage. The picture that was developing of Eugene Field was one of a violent man who, in the late 60s, was between marriages and, because of some unknown trigger, targeted Gwen Miller, 35 years his senior, as his victim that leap year day in 1968. It's impossible to know whether he had fixated on her for years after seeing her regularly for several months in 1963, or if he encountered her at the airport in 1968 and was reminded that she lived alone and was vulnerable, or both. Detective Keefe ruminates that it's possible that Field resented Gwen if she had let her distaste for the beautician's husband's abusive behavior be known. Perhaps she even said something in front of Field, and he took out his anger on her later, after his first marriage had fallen apart. We will never know. Eugene Field was not known to take taxis, so there's another aspect of the story that we will never know either. But the pieces all fit for Eugene Field to have been Gwen's killer. Eventually, Field moved to the northwestern part of the country and then to Wyoming. He worked at Ingalls Creek Lodge there. Field died on June 18, 2009, at age 66 from a cancerous tumor that cut off his air supply. Many people have cited the irony that he murdered Gwen by strangling her, and then he himself was essentially strangled by a malignant growth from within. Now, before putting the case to bed, of course, Detective Keefe had to verify that Eugene Field was Gwen's killer. And since Field was dead and had been cremated, that was not an easy task. Keefe spent hundreds of hours honing in on Field after receiving the family name from Dr. Fitzpatrick. And in doing so, he fleshed out the Field family tree. So he knew that Eugene Field's father, Vern, was an only child. His lineage indeed hailed from the UK, just as the genealogical research had suggested. Eugene had one brother, whom all call G rather than his full name, which I found online but is not public information. Eugene had no sons and only one daughter. G also had no sons. So the family tree was not large, and the number of people who could be the killer were limited to Eugene and his brother, G. Detective Keefe sat down with G and spoke with him at length. He told him that he believed his dead brother had murdered Gwen Miller 5 decades earlier. Of course, G had no idea that his brother was a suspected killer. He was skeptical of the idea and frankly did not believe it. G willingly gave a buccal sample so his DNA could be analyzed. When the results came in from the crime lab, they showed that the Y chromosome from G's sample was an exact match to that of the DNA from the crime scene. But he was not the killer, and neither was his father Vern, the analysts could determine from the chromosomal composition. Whoever was a match to the killer's DNA was almost certainly a sibling of G's, and he had only one. To be even more certain that G's only brother Eugene was the contributor of the DNA found on Gwen, Keefe submitted G's DNA and the crime scene DNA to a company called PTC Gene Trait Labs in Missouri. The lab determined that the probability of full siblingship of the two samples was 99.23%. And the lab confirmed that the killer was not Eugene and G's father Vern, who had no siblings, and neither Eugene nor G had a son. In other words, there was only a 0.77% chance that the killer was not the only full sibling of G's, Eugene Field. Detective Keefe went to many lengths to try to get Eugene's actual DNA. He even went so far as to track down vehicles Eugene had owned and swab them, but results were insufficient for comparison. In the end, Rapid City PD decided that they did not need to conduct a reverse paternity test on Eugene Field's daughter to confirm his DNA. The 99.23% likelihood that they had from his relatives was enough. And were he alive, this statistical likelihood that Eugene Field was Gwen's killer, plus his known contact with her and his history of abusing women, would have provided sufficient probable cause to arrest him for first-degree murder. At a press conference held on June 17, 2019, announcing the closure of the Gwen Miller case, Rapid City Police Chief Carl Jagaris said, quote, "Today, there's a slight celebratory mood because the case has been solved, but I assure you, the fact of how horrific this crime was wears heavy on each and every one of our hearts." At the presser, Detective Keefe recounted the facts of the case and how he eliminated everyone but Field. He said that all in, he invested between 4,000 and 5,000 hours on finding her killer. He later told me that this was a very conservative estimate. The case consumed him for several years, keeping him up at night, and he did much of the work on it for less than full pay. Gwen's niece, Kay Miller Temple, spoke at the press conference as well on behalf of the Miller family, who traveled from as far away as Arizona to attend. Kay was in fifth grade when Gwen was murdered, but she was not told the truth about her beloved aunt's death until she was in her late 20s. She read aloud a letter she wrote to her dear Aunt Gwen. It said, quote, "We always make sure we remember you for your life, not for the day you died. We think of you when we make your recipe for toasted cheese sandwiches, when we recall the special method you used to clean your wooden floor, your gorgeous rose garden and stone steps down to the creek. At family gatherings and visits, you always made sure to talk to the little ones." She went on to thank the investigators who spent decades working Gwen's case. She concluded with, "Today we've learned not about the why, but the who, and that will be enough for us. We want what we've learned to provide hope for other families. Thank you for giving us an answer." Detective Keefe later told me that one of the reasons he was so committed to solving Gwen's case was that, growing up, he had spent time in Crespard, where Gwen's family was from. In fact, he knew exactly where her family farm was, and Kay, Gwen's niece, went to high school with his cousin. This slight personal connection motivated Detective Keefe to pull out all the stops to solve the homicide of the progressive independent pharmacist, whose low-risk lifestyle nevertheless ended in her senseless murder. And he did. But the unanswered questions in this case will likely never be resolved. Detective Keefe told the Rapid City Journal that Field's motive and why and how he targeted Gwen remain unknowns. He said, quote, "Unless somebody comes forward with information that I don't have right now, the why part of this, we're never going to know." As for the question of whether Eugene Field has any additional victims, Detective Keefe does not believe so, at least in the Rapid City area. As for others farther afield, Keefe says that this is being explored. Field's DNA has been entered into CODIS, and information about him also entered into the NCIC database. If Field committed any other crimes with DNA, he will be identified. But as far as Detective Keefe knows, Field had only one arrest for a minor crime outside the state of South Dakota, so his genetic profile would not have been entered into the database. Detective Keefe was able to obtain a fingerprint card from the other jurisdiction, but the samples weren't of very good quality, and comparisons of the prints to those found in Gwen's home were inconclusive. But they didn't need the prints. The DNA said it all. Interestingly, though, Field's lack of a criminal record is telling. It looks as though Eugene Field was another one of our killers who was a one-off murderer with just one victim, who went on to lead his life without committing another homicide, or even any other known crime at all. Gwen's was the first case in Rapid City to be solved using DNA and genealogical research. After 51 years, Gwen Miller's case is finally closed thanks to forensic genealogy. And if you were one of the bad guys, they are coming for you. Special thanks to Detective Wayne Keefe of the Rapid City Police Department for speaking with me about this case. And now, I'd like to play a clip for you from a podcast I think you'll really enjoy called Reverie.
I'm Paige, the host of Reverie True Crime. I tell stories of helpless victims, vicious killers, predators watching their prey before they strike, survivors, petty crimes, people we think we know who do the unthinkable, and the dangers that lurk not only in the dead of night, but in plain sight in the light of day. Every once in a while, I'll also tell stories of the frightening paranormal, elusive cryptids, haunted locations, and conspiracies that may be silly or thought-provoking. You can listen to Reverie True Crime wherever you're listening to this podcast. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at Reverie Crime Pod, Facebook, Instagram, and even Tumblr at Reverie True Crime. Remember, stay safe, be aware of your surroundings at all times, and take care.
DNA ID is researched, written, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music composed by Connor Betancourt. To contact us, you can email the podcast at dnaidpodcast@gmail.com
or follow us on social media. You can find us at DNA ID Podcast on Instagram, at DNA ID Podcast on Twitter, and on Facebook at DNA ID Podcast. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime and Missing Persons.